McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, you're going to hear an excerpt from my memorable 2006 conversation with the great Bob Newhart. In part one of today's program, we're going to be talking baseball. This summer will mark the 60th anniversary of one of the great milestones in Major League Baseball history. It was 60 years ago this summer that Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle were in hot pursuit of one of the most important records in baseball, the single-season home run record of Babe Ruth. And of course, ultimately, that record was broken by Mr. Maris. On today's morning show, you'll hear a conversation I recorded back in 2001 with Steve Meyerhoff, who at the time was an editor for The Sporting News and largely responsible for two important books that were released that summer. One of them, Baseball, 100 Years of the Modern Era, and the other, 61, the story of Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle, and One Magical Summer. That book came out to mark the 40th anniversary of that occasion. This year, as we replay the conversation, it is the 60th anniversary of Roger Maris's great accomplishment.
I'd like to know a little bit about you, first of all, your connection to the sports world and how you ascended to the editorial position at the Sporting News. Did you come up through journalism or through sports or through both?
I came up through journalism, loving sports, and playing sports and loving journalism all at the same time. I worked at various points in my career in newspapers and magazines, and I've kind of grown up now in my journalism career, and I'm in books. More appropriately, I guess, for our conversation, I'm a baseball fan, and I want to combine my interests and my loves, which happen to be sports and baseball and journalism, and try to bring them in a way that I enjoy to people.
One of the things I've heard said about baseball is that it is the sport which has by far inspired the highest level of discussion over the years and the highest level of writing and analysis. You don't have just fans up in the stands just sort of cheering their heads off, although that's part of it, but it's also the kind of game that really inspires all kinds of study and analysis and celebration. I mean, all kinds of fascinating stuff has been said and written about baseball over the years.
Yeah, and you hear a lot of different theories about why that's the case, I don't think there's any disputing what you say. And the best explanation that I have heard is it's because the game itself allows you to do that. You can't go out to an NBA game or an NHL game or an NFL game. It's so frantic and frenetic and everything's happening, in football you got, situational changes coming in, and in hockey, you're barely trying to find the puck, and in basketball the game has just gotten so fast and so big. But with baseball it kind of invites that instant analysis among people in the stands and people on the radio and, people in broadcasting. It's just the pace of the game. And it's what I enjoy about it. I'm getting older, and I can't keep up with everybody and kind of that frantic lifestyle. And more and more I grow to love this game just for that reason.
it's been interesting to see the upswing in interest in Major League Baseball after the really crushing blow of the strike a few years back. And I suppose we have Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa in part to thank for that, as well as maybe a documentary maker named Ken Burns have all sort of played a part in helping to reestablish baseball as a real favorite.
Yeah, and I'd go back, really somewhere in between both of those. And clearly the summer of 98 with McGwire and Sosa and, the whole chase, captivated not just baseball fans, but non-baseball fans, and, kind of reintroduced people, reignited and reinvigorated people. But you can even go back to the Cal Ripken breaking of Lou Gehrig's record, and even further back, and kind of in the same vein, is the creation of Camden Yard, kind of taking baseball back to a simpler, older time. It's where I point to where there has been kind of this reinvigoration for the game, and I think we have players to thank for that, like Cal and Big Mac and Sammy, and it's continuing now. You're seeing all the new old ballparks that people are becoming very fascinated with, and you've got great stories going on in Barry Bonds, and the Cubs are playing well right now, and the White Sox and Pedro, so it's been kind of a bit of a halcyon days for Major League Baseball, and what everyone is doing right now is crossing their fingers and hoping that both sides of the equation here, both management and players, don't blow it and do something foolish this offseason.
Hmm. I wonder if you've seen the video series When It Was a Game.
Absolutely.
Includes all kinds of wonderful home movies from Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, I have a copy of one in my personal collection at home. I think it was the second movie they had made. It's a terrifically done series, and I know Ross Greenberg at HBO Sports it's a passion of his. It's his project, and I know they're looking at another version of that, and they're truly, to see, Wrigley Field in an older era in color is really mind-boggling.
Yeah. When you think about the title, When It Was a Game, that implies that it's not a game now. Do you agree with that? I mean, the charge that baseball in its essential form has profoundly changed from those days of yesteryear that many look back on with such fondness?
Well, I think the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and it's really up to those who are referring to the game, to kind of answer that question. Is it still a game for me? Yeah, most of the time. I can go out to the ballpark on a nice warm St. Louis evening and enjoy a ball game just for the sake of it being a ball game. There are other people who can't do that because of whatever situation it is. Fans may complain about the high salaries, or they may complain about the high ticket prices, or they may complain about the labor situation that I alluded to. But I think, to truly get an answer to your question, it's really up to the person himself or herself answering that.
I'm talking to you from Kenosha, Wisconsin, and you mentioned the Cubs, who are just to the south of us, mm-hmm. Of course, in beloved Wrigley Field. The real big baseball story around here would be our neighbors to the north, the Milwaukee Brewers, and their magnificent new ballpark, Miller Park. Have you had a chance to experience that yet yourself?
I have not. I came very close to having an opportunity to visit a night game there, but a couple of meetings got canceled, and I was unable to go. I'm looking forward to it, and actually I should be in the next day or two visiting the new ballpark in San Francisco, which I had not seen yet. I try to make it a habit, a ritual wherever I am, to try to add at least a new ballpark each year. From what I hear of Milwaukee, it's an absolutely terrific facility, and from the players in the way they talk about it, it really has changed the mindset and the attitude about going there. And I think it's really created a home field advantage for Milwaukee that they haven't had over the past few years.
Well, and my observation is that it has galvanized attention in the way that you mentioned Mr. Sosa and Mr. McGuire doing with their great home run race that even people who don't call themselves baseball fans in any way, shape, or form find themselves almost in spite of themselves drawn into the excitement.
Sure. Well, the key to that, of course, is maintaining that interest and that staying power. And Camden Yard did that, when it was initially built, and is truly one of one of my favorite ballparks. But as that team has gone south, and now we know that Cal is intending this to be his final season.
Right.
It's not enough. The honeymoon is over. You got to keep putting good product on the field. So, while Miller Park is a tremendous destination for people and an attraction to non-baseball fans, you continually got to maintain that interest, and the best way to do that is to put a good team on the field.
That brings to mind the discussion that really continues to rage, I think, is really the word, about the way in which Major League Baseball is organized, and if there are ways in which footing can be a little more equitable between various teams and so on. Do you personally wish that Major League Baseball was doing things differently?
You can take that question a lot of different ways. I would like to see a balanced schedule, something that is more equitable for the teams themselves. I'm not a fan of interleague play, and I think that is beneficial to some teams over the others. I'm not a fan of the designated hitter. I think that it creates an unjust situation in interleague games and in the World Series. So, in that regard, I'd like to see things evened out. If I'm trying to answer it on the basis of kind of a home field configuration, one of the beauties of baseball is to have these, to have different playing dimensions. It's not like hockey or football or basketball again. It's so different. So you'll hear a lot of people who will be yelling about Enron Field in Houston, for example, or Coors Field in Denver, and how unfair those types of places are. I kind of throw my hands up sometimes and say, of course all these records are going to fall when they're playing in little bandboxes. But on the other hand, that's the charm of baseball. So I guess the answer to your question is, I'd like to see some things kind of evened out on some levels. But in other situations in the game of baseball, that's what baseball's all about. It's about being different.
Right. How about the fact that baseball seems to mean big business, and the fact that some teams seem to have so much in the way of resources compared to others?
I try to enjoy a ball game for a ball game, and sure, I get tired of the Yankees winning, for example, and I get tired of the big market teams who can dominate. But you look at the situation now and look at the quote-unquote big market teams, and it's not the Dodgers who are playing tremendously well in the big markets. You got the Yankees, of course. The Mets aren't. The two Chicago teams are playing very well right now, whether you consider them kind of in the big market in terms of salary. You can kind of dispute. But I go out and try to enjoy the game of baseball for the game of baseball, no matter if it's the Kansas City Royals playing or if it's the New York Yankees playing. Believe me, I'll be out there booing every day for the Yankees, but it's not because they have the highest salary in baseball. It's because I've just never been a Yankee fan.
We're talking with Steve Meyerhoff, who is editorial director of the Sporting News. The Sporting News has recently released, a little earlier this year, two great books about baseball, neither of which I've really had a chance to read, just to look at. I look forward to reading both of them. One is called Baseball, 100 Years of the Modern Era, 1901 to 2000. And, of course, that's a tall order to pile all of that history into one volume.
Yeah, well, I tell people that I was smart. I got one of my senior editors here who is very capable of doing that, so I didn't have to make the difficult decisions necessarily on what gets in and what gets not, because when you're looking at 100 years of history, and trying to determine how to cram it into 356 pages in a book, that's a pretty tall order and a daunting task. Irregardless of that, it was a fun process because I didn't do much work. We didn't do much work. It was all the people in the 100 years prior to the publication of this book who have worked at the Sporting News who have done this all for us. You know, Sporting News began in 1886, the modern era that most people, you know, in the creation of the American League, you know, having come about for the 1901 season. You know, the Sporting News and a set of writers and reporters and correspondents and over time illustrators and photographers, you know, chronicled the game. And they did all the work. We sat back and found what they did on kind of the hallmark points in baseball history and try to bring it to you as it happened in, you know, the pages of what was once called the Bible of baseball. And that was our job, is to try to create the Bible for the last 100 years so that people will know how we did things and how things happened as they happened.
Wow. The other book that you have just released is called 61, The Story of Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle, and One Magical Summer. And, of course, many people probably saw on HBO that marvelous film of the same name, which has some sort of relationship with the book.
Right. We embarked on the project about a year ago at this time when we really began in earnest. And we, of course, knew that HBO was planning a documentary, planning a movie, I guess is a better term, on 61. And we thought it was appropriate for the Sporting News to let people know, you know, what 61 was like. We chronicled 1998 for people in a book called Celebrating 70, and we wanted to do the same thing for that 61 season. So as we went along and we started discussing with HBO the opportunity to partner together, we did have a limited partnership whereby Billy Crystal, who was the director, the executive director of the film, provided the foreword for us, and we wrote about how the movie was made in the book, and we had a real nice relationship with HBO. I thought the movie was terrific, and I would never do a project like this, linked to a partner, if I wasn't real comfortable with the movie itself. But he did a terrific job. Tells a great story, the emotional story of Roger Maris and his relationship with Mickey and Roger with his wife Pat and Roger with the fans in New York. And we wanted to tell the story about baseball and what that summer was like for people, fans, for the players, and you know, how a baseball publication like ourselves actually covered that summer.
So for those of us who were, well, like me, 1 year old in 1961, and who really weren't there, even those of us who've read about it and seen movies about it, in what way was that a magical summer? Take us back.
Well, let me tell you, I'm in almost the same boat as you. I was, I guess, minus one. So I don't remember it at all either. You know, I really got done with the book, and you know, it was a fascinating process because I didn't know anything about it. I'd heard a lot, and of course, the summer of '98 brought a lot of the stories of Roger Maris and his family, you know, back into the news. And I had heard the stories about Roger losing his hair and the pressure, but until I did this, and looked at it, I truly didn't understand that. I tell people that. You know, yeah, it was a movie, but you couldn't have written a more dramatic script. I mean, here are two guys in the marquee baseball capital of the world, you know, the media capital of the world, New York City. You know, the one guy who is who has, you know, kind of the golden boy, but one who has kind of been whipped for years because you know, he's taking over for the legend Joe DiMaggio, who all of a sudden becomes instead of the antagonist, he's the protagonist. And you got this other guy, Roger Maris, who is vilified by New York fans and you know, by some accounts, you know, even teammates and players. You couldn't have written a more dramatic story and had people tell you, you know, that was very believable. You know, Crystal told me a story about the making of the movie when we were doing the foreword. And there was a point in the season where, actually, it was the game in Baltimore where, you know, Roger either had to hit the home run, it was going to be the 154th game, or, you know, it wasn't going to be, you know, constituted as the record, and he did not show up for an interview with a New York reporter, and, you know, Billy kind of, glosses over that situation and never really explained why Roger never showed up. Well, Roger didn't show up because Whitey Herzog, who was his teammate with the Yankees at the time, asked him to visit a sick kid in Baltimore. And Billy knew that. And Billy said, you know, I couldn't put that in the story because, you know, the story was so hard to believe anyway that, you know, people really wouldn't believe that. Well, it was believable. It happened. It was reality. And you couldn't have written a better story. The sheer drama, the sheer pressure that must have been put on, you know, I comprehend more having gotten done with this book project and having seen the movie, but I have this feeling I don't even scratch the surface on what it was like. Hmm. You know, it's one of those situations where, and this is what I want to do with every book that we do in regard to history, and especially baseball history, is try to take people back, or, you know, let people relive, you know, how things happen, something that can kind of pass generation to generation. And, you know, doing this project helped me relive what that must have been like, which by all accounts was, you know, unbelievable.
I suppose one of the things we should be really grateful for is that Mark McGwire, as he captured that record, was so careful to pay tribute to Roger Maris and did so so graciously and with just the utmost of class. I could imagine someone else breaking that record and not even glancing backward.
Well, you know, like him or not, and I think McGwire has his critics as well as his fans, you know, baseball history means something to him. And not just in baseball, but in a lot of other sports, you don't see contemporary players have that respect for history and the players who have preceded them and their accomplishments. And, you know, that was not an act by Mark. You know, he truly felt and said what he said. He has a profound respect for baseball history and for Roger Maris and what he went through. And you know, I know I've read comments from him over the past several weeks, you know, as Barry Bonds is on this incredible pace about, you know how difficult this is going to be. The pressure, you know, in 98 was incredible, as it was in 61. And, you know, Mark, to his credit, recognized that and paid tribute to Roger and his family for getting through that.
Well, and it really does put into perspective, maybe for all of us, since we can't really talk to Mr. Maris or Mr. Mantle anymore, about what had to be going on inside of them.
Yeah, you know, Billy Crystal was very good friends with Mickey, and he tells great stories about the first time he met him and how he became a fan. And Billy also says he'd never had a chance to meet Roger. But, you know, what's going through these guys and you know, what they were thinking is something we'd all like to get a handle on. And then Billy, I think, clearly was in a position and able to execute that. He'd spent hours talking to Mickey, you know, over the course of many years. And he'd talk about the movie and how, you know, the hours of talking with Mickey, all of this kind of comes out. And, you know, what's going through these guys' heads is a difficult thing to get to, especially now that both of these men have passed. But certainly I think something that came through in the movie itself.
Mm-hmm. What about the relationship between the two players, so different from one another in so many ways?
Well, I think over time, you know, there was a great fallacy that these guys were really at each other's throats. They were competitive, you know, but let's think about it. They're athletes. They're supposed to be competitive. That's what they do for a living, and you know, they're going to be that way. You know, on the other hand, they weren't as animistic, I think, as people made them out to be. I think they were very respectful of each other, and you know, to the point of being very helpful. You know, there's a, you know, the movie itself talks about you know, how Roger literally rescued, you know, Mickey, you know, who was by all kinds accounts kind of spiraling into, you know, being out at all hours and drinking, and you know, Roger invited him to stay in his queen's apartment, and you know, they were roommates, and I don't know how much closer you can get than that. So I think the relationship was much closer than people gave it credit for, a competitive one, but one of respect for each other.
Right. A lot has been said about how the public and the press too misunderstood Roger Maris. I mean, didn't give him credit. I mean, maybe jumped to conclusions about him because of his sort of stoic, unsmiling demeanor and
right.
And so on. I wonder, as editor of Sporting News, when you look back at the way the Sporting News, for instance, covered this back in 1961, was the Sporting News and its writers fair to Roger Maris?
Yeah, I think we were. I think there's a little bit of a difference, and let me explain myself. And I may feel like I'm going a little wayward here, but there's a point. In 1982, when the Brewers and the Cardinals played in the World Series, you know, I think there was a lot of criticism around the country about, you know, what a boring World Series that's going to be. And I remember, you know, having I was a devout collector of Sports Illustrated's, and I remember when, you know, the Cardinals won that series, and my issue of Sports Illustrated came, and the Cardinals weren't on the cover, and that made me furious. And for all these years, I had kept my Sports Illustrated's, and I didn't keep that issue. It was my kind of my personal way of, you know, thumbing my nose at it. Well, you know, my point is, I think that the kind of the East Coast media, you know, really doesn't understand the Midwest mentality, and I think the Roger was miscast by the New York media because he was the way most people in the Midwest are, kind of unassuming, and you know, they're not gonna, you know, fly off on Deion Sanders-ish quotes and, you know, being outlandish, and you know, that was perceived by the media as being quote unquote boring or boorish or, you know, kind of you know, offish, and I think that was unfair. The Sporting News, having been based in St. Louis, though it's a national publication, I think kind of expressed that more even-handedly and fairer than, you know, certainly the New York papers did. You know, the way we covered that summer in part was, you know, talking to a lot of players about, you know, should the record be or should it not be with an asterisk. So, you know, we were presenting that information. But I think, you know, being of Midwestern stock, as it were, much like Maris, I think we understood a whole lot better his demeanor than the New York press did.
Of course, 1961 was an entirely different era than we live in now. And now the media is everywhere. It's in our cars and in our workplaces and just seems to intrude on every arena of life. In 1961, was it a little more possible for Maris and Mantle to put the media attention aside, or even in that era, was it at such a level that it just could not be ignored?
Well, I think clearly, you know, the situation is much different now than it was then, and I think it would have been easier, you know, to kind of let that lie in 1961. But, you know, in the other part of that great dramatic story that I was talking about having been written in reality is the fact that these guys were chasing the great Babe Ruth, and, you know, who was their, you know, teammate, so to speak. And it was the New York record. You know, people were going to be very protective of that. So with that in mind, I don't care who was going for it in what market, I think the media in 61 would have been all over the situation. You know, clearly now, and I point to ourselves because we are a very multimedia publisher now, being on the web and in mobile communications and, you know, electronic publishing, everything. But right now, I don't think anyone could escape the pressure with everybody coming at you from, you know, the broadcast world, the radio world, the web world, the print world. You know, everyone's coming at you.
Yeah. In your book, do you really delve at all into 1962 and 1963? In other words, into the aftermath, or do you really try to focus your attention on this one particular summer?
Well, we do focus on 61, but where the movie stops, and the movie stops when Roger Maris hits number 61 that year. I hope I'm not giving this away, but he does hit 61 for for anyone. You know, we do go beyond that, and there's a great story to tell about the World Series that year, and you know, a lot of people get lost into this great chase. What another great season it was for the Yankees and Whitey Ford and Yogi and a lot of their other players. Anyway, but we go on and tell the story of their careers and their paths that they took after that, and you know, they're equally compelling stories. It's a tragic story for Roger, I think, who couldn't live in that New York market in that pressure, or vice versa, maybe that the New York fans really, you know, never truly respected him, and he came to St. Louis and played here for several seasons, and probably has a more devout following. There's probably a more respect here for him in his few short seasons, where he didn't accomplish this great thing in 61 than he did in New York. And of course he died early in 1985. And of course there's the story of Mickey, who often injured and probably never attained the legendary status that a lot of people thought. Clearly he's one of the greats of the game, but I think with the injuries, people had expected him to go even beyond that. And again, you know, the tragic story of his eventual death just a few years ago. So, you know, our book goes beyond 61, and that's a distinction to be made in the movie, which again stops in October of 61.
Mm-hmm. At the time of Roger Maris's death, had a significant amount of reappraisal occurred? Had our appreciation for him deepened to any great extent, or did that happen really only after his death?
I think with Roger or with Mickey.
I was thinking more of Roger Maris, actually.
With Roger, I don't think Roger really got the respect he deserved until 98. I really don't. I don't think that people understood that. I think Roger died in 1985, so there was fully, a significant amount of time between his death and the chase of 98. That it was kind of an afterthought. Everyone remembered 61 and 61, but it kind of became a mantra and just some numbers, and people didn't understand what went into accomplishing that. Until 98, when Mark brought it out to people, I don't think people really understood what had happened. I think there's a significant more, another level of respect that have come since the movie. People have really come away, weeping for the story, but, weeping for what this man had to go through. So, it's pretty poignant that it took not just this man's death and not just this, this superhuman 70 home run season. It took this movie to tell people what this was really like, for Roger really to get what he deserves. And some people will argue that he still hasn't yet. Some people will argue that this guy should be in the Hall of Fame, and until that happens, he hasn't really gotten what he deserves.
Hmm. Well, we appreciate your time, Steve Meyerhoff, in telling us about that memorable summer of 1961 and the book that has just been released through the Sporting News, 61, The Story of Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle, and One Magical Summer, and the other volume called Baseball, 100 Years of the Modern Era, 1901 to 2000. I imagine that's one of those heavy coffee table books that could weigh you down.
You know what? It can, but I tell people it's not meant to be read. It's meant to be savored. It's meant to be, you know, opened up on occasion and, you know, take a look. It's a very visual, very illustrated history, and the last thing I want people to do is feel like it's a encyclopedic kind of accounting of baseball. This is a, you know, come and enjoy baseball in a very visual way with us.
Celebration.
Yes.
What's next from Sporting News?
Well, we have a lot of different projects right now. We just completed a project with the NBA on the Lakers championship season. We've got a book that we recently completed on the Colorado Avalanche in their Stanley Cup championship season. We're working very hard on a Cal Ripken book that we've been working on for about the last 2 years, and you know, we're gonna enjoy the last 2 months of this guy's career, because he's truly you know, one of the players who should be most respected in the game today. And we got a real fun project coming out in the fall called Game Faces, which is a collection of Sporting News images from as far back as, you know, the 20s, capturing the game of baseball in portraits, non-action pictures of candid images of players and the game. So we've got a lot on our plate right now.
Well, it sounds like fun, and maybe we'll get to talk again sometime.
Absolutely.
As events warrant. Steve Meyerhoff, we thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, you're going to hear an excerpt from a memorable 2006 Morning Show conversation, which I was privileged to record with the great Bob Newhart. The occasion of our conversation was the publication of his book, I Shouldn't Even Be Doing This, and Other Things That Strike Me as Funny. WGTD is actually located right between Milwaukee and Chicago, so our listeners are especially interested to hear all that you have to say about the wonderful city of Chicago, with whom you have such a close relationship. One thing in particular I think is especially interesting is when you say something about Chicago audiences. You say Chicago audiences just can't be fooled by a stand-up comic. In other cities, people sort of laugh where they're supposed to laugh, but people in Chicago only laugh when something is funny. Any idea why that is, and also how you've experienced that yourself?
I don't know why it is. I just know it is. I know that there you can't fool a Midwest audience as you can fool other audiences, say a San Francisco or New York audience, because there are certain buzzwords that, like Kafka. If you can work Kafka into it, you generally, a New York audience will laugh. Also putting on airs. People always say, well, you seem like pretty much like you were, you know, when you first started out. And I said, well, we have this thing in the Midwest about putting on airs, you know, and don't act like something you're not, you know.
So you think that's part of why you've sort of stayed so true to yourself, that because Chicago audiences just wouldn't have tolerated much of anything else?
Well, that, and I had a wife who kept me grounded and never let me really get too full of myself.
Very good. I know the feeling. you have also, among other things, given some of the credit for your particular wonderful, refreshing brand of comedy to some of the work which you did in law school, and in particular, an appreciation for the precise word. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, for instance, in the best example I can think of in a routine, which is one of the original routines that I started out with, submarine commander, and it's a routine on a man who, especially in service or in a large corporation, it's an example of.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Slight in any way the contribution made by the men we had to leave on deck. I think they had a lot to do with the 2 minutes we were able to cut off the record, and I doubt if any of us will soon forget their somewhat stunned expressions as we watched them through the periscope. So I think slight is just the right word, and stunned expressions is just the right word for. I think I took that with me from law school. It's one of the few things I ever took from law school.
We're glad that you did. You also talk about how comedians have to be at heart anti-authority, subversive in some sort of way. It's interesting for you to say that because, of course, those probably aren't the first couple of terms which most people would gravitate towards in trying to describe you or your brand of comedy. I mean, other people have been more obviously subversive. In what way has the work you've done been subversive in the way you're talking about?
Well, it's in there. It's very subtle, but it's in there. For instance, when I did the retirement party, and that was really based on my experience when I was an accountant, and I worked for an insurance company, and because someone I first did that and. Someone wrote me a letter, and they said, they were offended that I was making fun of Charlie Bedloe, who was receiving the watch after 50 years with the company, and who was he was blotto all the time, and I wrote back and explained to him that I wasn't making fun of Charlie; I was making fun of the system that made him get blotto every day. To get through the day. That's the only way you could get through the day. And again, in the submarine commander, it's making fun of the large corporation or the military. And then Abe Lincoln, of course, is making fun of a revered former president. So there is that element. It may be understated, but it's in. I think it's in almost every routine.
We're speaking with Bob Newhart about his wonderful new memoir called I Shouldn't Even Be Doing This and Other Things That Strike Me as Funny. You talk about how, especially in the first years of your career, you were writing almost all of your material in a vacuum, not really knowing if it was ever going to be performed. Do you think that was a helpful thing in a sense, that you were writing it in that way? Did it give you maybe a certain sort of a freedom?
Yeah, I suppose it was, Greg. Ed Gallagher and we had a syndicated radio program, which was eminently unsuccessful. We finally wound up costing us money to do it, and then Ed got an offer for a job in New York, so I was kind of on my own. Either I had to find another partner or do it as a single, and even though I had no outlet for it, I would see something and it would strike me funny, and I had to write it down. I had to get it down on paper before I forgot it. Even though I never knew where I was going to ever have a chance to perform it.
Those routines, some of them at least, came to light and were shared on PBS in the wonderful American Masters special they did about you. That must have really felt pretty cool, that a show that devotes itself to people like Leonard Bernstein devoted its resources to celebrating you and your career.
Exactly, and it was. And I don't know that it was so much a salute to me as it was a salute to the role of comedy and the role that comedy plays in our lives. And how important comedy is to our lives.
Absolutely. You talk in wonderful detail in your memoir about that marvelous show, which debuted in the 1970s, which so many of us enjoyed and have practically memorized word for word. I especially liked one thing you said about the way that your marriage with Emily was crafted in the Bob Newhart show. You said there was the perfect amount of tension, love, and respect to make that marriage feel real. We read those words and we realize so seldom is that balance correctly achieved elsewhere.
Yeah, that pretty accurately describes, the relationship that Emily and I had, and we had respect for each other, and she was independent, but at the same time, dependent in a way on me and me on her.
Hmm. You say that in that show, it's 85% the real Bob and 15% is TV Bob. In other words, we're mostly seeing you. Most of the time when we've seen you on television and film, is that about the right proportion?
Yes. My wife has always said, if the American public ever found out what you were really like, they would never show up. Of course, my response was, "And we're going to keep that secret, aren't we? if we want to keep living the way we're living." So,
very good.
I tend to find humor in the. I tend to deal with misfortune humorously.
You also touch at one point about how one of the costs of fame is that you're not necessarily out and about in the grocery store aisles and so on like you once were. And of course, it's those real-life encounters which generated so much of your material.
Yeah, in a way, your success, which we're all trying to achieve, it kind of cuts you off from the source of your material. And it means you just have to work a little harder at developing your material and finding it.
Well, you seem to manage to do that. Of course, your later career has also included some dramatic acting, that marvelous run on ER, for instance. Do you hope to do more of that?
Yeah, I would love to, if given the right script. And I was highly complimented that John Wells thought that I was up to that role. I always call that my first intentionally dramatic role. There have been other comedic roles I played that turned out to be tragic. That was the first intentionally dramatic role, and so not really based on what he had seen me do, but he just felt I could handle it, and I felt very complimented, and the writing was marvelous.
Well, and the folks who nominated you for an Emmy apparently thought you did a good job as well.
Yeah, apparently.
Very good. For all that you've given the American public, we thank you, and I thank you for writing this wonderful book. I shouldn't even be doing this. A pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Bob Newhart.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking with Adam Koenig, who is on the staff at Carthage College, Director of Alumni Relations. And he is the person who is, to a large extent, responsible for designing and implementing an absolutely wonderful and groundbreaking commencement ceremony for the most recent graduates of Carthage College. We're going to be talking with him about the kind of conversations that went on in terms of how to do commencement during the COVID-19 pandemic. Also, a look at what it means to be or to have a life coach. On Friday's morning show, Edson Melendez will be telling us about Brew City Opera's latest project, which celebrates the wonderful music of Paolo Tosti. Also, we'll be talking with Rachel Swartz from the University of Wisconsin Parkside about their production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, which opens this coming weekend. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. It's also available as a podcast. In fact, you can hear the morning show 7 days a week via the podcast.